Mehmed II, Sultan of the mighty Ottoman Empire, lay siege to Constantinople using massive bombards built by Urban from Hungary, blows holes in the Theodosian walls, gets into the city. His soldiers rape, loot, pillage for 3 days. And then the ancient heart of Byzantium is claimed as the new capital of the Ottoman Empire. At that point, trade routes shut down because land trade had been coming across all the way from China and Korea via the Silk Road, thanks in part to the Mongolians. But now, with Constantinople seized and that whole Black Sea region a war zone, trade stopped. Europeans, the Portuguese, Spanish, want access to those luxury goods that come from Asia, and so they seek to do the unthinkable. Go around the Islamic heartland by taking advantage of technology, by taking advantage of the sea. So the Portuguese leave first. They began a series of expeditions funded profitably by the monarch, initially the prince, but later the monarch, in which the captains would get 80% of whatever they found in the investor, the king, would get 20%. They eventually get around the Cape of Good Hope. They find that they can get to the Asia by sea. That story inspires the Spanish to do the same thing, except they go west. Slam right into Morocco. Of course, they didn't quite know what they had, but they would figure it out. And once they arrive, the Spanish, still fired up from their crusades, the Reconquista of the Iberian Peninsula, from the Muslims, they essentially used that ferocity, the sword and the cross, to conquer the New World. They fan out across the Caribbean, conquer the islands there. Then eventually they would make land in the Yucatan Peninsula, in Mexico, and they would begin conquering there. Now, one of the most amazing aspects of what the Spanish did and the conquistadors did was how easy it was for them. I mean, like, seriously, how easy it was. Embarrassingly so. Hernando Cortez attacks the Aztec Empire, whose population estimated somewhere between 12 and 16 million people. But he only had 630 soldiers. But he topples the Aztecs and seizes all of central Mexico for the Spanish crown. Then, 20 years later, Pizarro, with even less men, 180 total, attacks and topples the Inca Empire. Estimated population of the Inca Empire is somewhere between 8 and 10 million people. And the Inca Empire, geographically, was huge. It stretched from Colombia all the way down to Chile. How did they do it? How did they do it?
Disease.
It had nothing to do with their tactics. Yes, sure, they had guns. I'll give you that. But the firearms they had weren't even muskets. They were, I think, arquebuses or blunderbusses. I forgot the name of them. They're basically just like hand cannons. Took a couple of minutes to load. And even if you loaded it and fired it, there was no guarantee it would go off. And it was not accurate. You had a better chance of throwing a baseball at the side of a barn as hitting somebody with these guns the Spanish had. They also had a chance of blowing up in the Spanish soldiers' hands. Did they have some horses? Yes. Were there any horses in Central America or South America at this time? No. Did they wear armor? Yes. But again, a few hundred versus millions. Well, the one thing the Spanish did not realize, and this was not intentional, is they carried with them estimated upwards of anywhere being up to 30 diseases. Diseases that were commonplace in Europe and in Asia and in Africa and in the Middle East. Things like the flu, influenza, smallpox, malaria, heck, even the bubonic plague. These diseases, some reach pandemic levels throughout history. But the Eurasian African landmasses, the people always survived. And because of their exposure, they built up resistance. FYI, why do you think the death rate was so high with the COVIDs? What did Fauci and all his infinite wisdom force everyone to do? To hide in their homes, to isolate, to run away in fear. Well, truth be told, if people came in contact with one another, your bodies might have had a greater chance of fighting it. Particularly if you were outside moving around being active. Not hiding in your bedrooms. Terrified. Well, these diseases had not been present in Central America or South America. And they ravaged the population. If you read through the primary sources, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of tales of conquistadors walking into villages completely depopulated. Everyone was dead. And the death, on average, ranged on this scale. All throughout the new Spanish Empire, anywhere between 30 to 90% of the population died. So what did that do to the Aztec population? I don't know, 15, 16 million people? Well, it was reduced to about 3 million by 1600. What did it do to the Inca population? 10 to 12 million? Dropped to about 1.5 million. Many of the islands in the Caribbean, completely depopulated. By the way, the same thing happened up in North America. So, the British didn't necessarily conquer the Indians. By the time the British got here, most of the native tribes along the Atlantic coast were already wiped out. And again, the key thing to remember is they did not know. They didn't have science. They didn't have knowledge of this stuff. But the natives interpreted it as proof positive that the Christian God was way more powerful than their own. And then what did the Spanish do to them? Well, they created an empire. The King of Spain ordered the conquest of all of these cultures, even empires. And they were absorbed into a big blanket umbrella. All for the profit of Spain. And this was a true imperial system. It was top down. There was no democracy. Sitting at the top of the mountain, literally, proverbially, was the king. The king had absolute authority over the New World Empire. All of the lands that were conquered were legally, under the Spanish legal system, considered to be his property, which meant he could do with it as he wanted. And guess what he wanted to do with that more land? He wanted to make more money. Because if he could make more money off that more land, he could get more power. Well, obviously, the king in Spain had no idea what was going on in Central America, or the Caribbean, or South America. No idea. The king was just born into it. But the king would create a government committee, bureaucracy, known as the Council of Indies, that would help him to draft policy. The laws for the colonies. The rules. But of course, the Council of Indies couldn't tell the king what to do. The king told them what he wanted. More and more and more. The most important duty of the Council of Indies was to hire the king's representative, who would get on a boat, sail across the Atlantic, and essentially govern this vast domain. These governors would be known as viceroys. And their job was to govern zones. Initially, they divided it into two, and then later they would divide it into four. The former Aztec Empire was known as the Viceroyalty of New Spain. This was a colony. And then the former Inca Empire was known as the Viceroyalty of Peru. These men were entrusted with enforcing the king's will in their colonies. They made sure the laws were followed. They made sure the colonial enterprises were profitable. But even these colonies were vast domains. How do you make sure the laws are followed? How do you make sure justice ensues? Well, you then take the colony and you divide it up into chunks. And these become known as audiencias. These are like districts, if you will, or provinces. And I don't know what word would help you remember better. Well, the job of the audiencias, and by the way, in charge of each audiencia was the equivalent of a judge. The judge would hear disputes. And even the natives could basically go to these courts and file a claim and get justice. But of course, the judges would enforce the king's will. Well, you teach each province, and you subdivide it even further. Because there's a lot of space in between urban centers. These counties, if you will, were known as gobernaciones. This included all of the land in between the cities or the large towns, all of the countryside. The officials in charge of all of this vast space had to make sure that law was followed, that there was no crime, that the native populations didn't organize and attempt to rebel. And then within each gobernación, cabildos, These are the cities, these are the towns. Typically, they were governed by a council of Spaniards who came over and were given local positions of prominence. They owned the land. They were the big farmers or the businessmen. Their job was to make sure that the cities functioned properly. But this system was all top down. The king made the law. It went to the Council of Indies, which was dispatched to the viceroys. The viceroys made sure the judges enforced the rules, that all within between the rural areas were governed effectively. And of course, there was no crime, rapes, assassinations, death in the cities as well. This is the structure they put in place. And this is what allowed Spain to basically control this vast domain across a 7,000-mile ocean. Questions?
How long does that take Spain to?
Depends on the time of year you went. So it could be as quick as 3 weeks, or it could take you as long as 2 months, if you even made it at all. Because remember, you're basically in a wooden box in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. What do you think the people on those wooden boxes thought the moment they heard a talk about an oh shit moment? Because who are you going to call? Exactly. Many, many ships just disappeared. But if you could get over here and you were given a land grant by the king, you could be fabulously wealthy. So it was worth the risk. Other questions? Well, why didn't the natives rebel? Even decimated. You're still talking millions compared to a few thousand. Why didn't they rebel? Well, they were kept in line ethically, morally, by the church. Coming across with the conquistadors were missionaries, typically Jesuit priests, whose job was to spread the faith. And interestingly enough, they also brought with them the Inquisition. So if you dared try to hide heresy, you could be tortured until you confess your sins and beg the church for forgiveness. Now, one of the most amazing aspects of this was that the Pope, who was so focused on profits, basically allowed the Catholic priests to become agents of the Spanish crown. The Pope gave them to the crown as a gift. So what the priests were doing over here was not necessarily based on the will of the Pope. But instead they were obeying the rules of state. Why? I think 30%. 30% of anything that the crown took in would be given to the church. So what would you do for a Colandec bar? Well, the papacy knew that if the Spanish were able to make this part of the world profitable, they would stand to gain bazillions of dollars. Because the Spanish are devoted Catholics. They never had a Protestant Reformation. They stayed within the Catholic realm. So if Spain could make this profitable, the church would benefit. And by the way, this is an understatement. because the conquest also took place at around the time that Martin Luther appeared. After he read the writings of the conciliarists and started daring, asking questions about how the Catholic Church had become corrupt and deviated from its central mission. Well, the last thing these Catholic priests wanted was to allow all of these natives to become Protestants. So they came over with all ferocity. And by the way, super successful. How many of you have ancestry that comes from Central or South America or from the Caribbean? You speak the native language of the natives that were there?
Just a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? What language?
I speak Spanish. I'm from the Central Mexico.
So. Okay, now, no. So your people were probably part of the Aztec Empire.
Yeah.
Do you got any Aztec in your vocabulary?
No.
Do you do any human sacrifices?
No.
Do you worship the sun god or the rain god?
Nope.
No. What language do you speak?
Spanish.
Oh, what religion are you?
Catholic.
Oh, geez, I wonder why. That's how successful the Catholic priests were. They were more successful in Central and South America and the Caribbean than anywhere else in the world. They managed to almost entirely eradicate the culture of the people that were there. Today, that would be referred to as a cultural genocide. And it happened quick. That's another amazing aspect. Most of the natives converted to Catholicism within a generation after the conquest by the Spaniards. Because, like I said, the natives viewed the Christian God as more powerful than their own. And who doesn't like being on the winning team? Let's do a little bandwagonism, right? We don't want to root for the losers. We want to root for the winners. Questions. Well, the crown, above all else, wanted money. It got all the land. It wanted more money so it could become more powerful. So how did they do it? Well, they implemented a system that was known as the Encomedia. The Encomedia system was a system that involved tribute in which the native peoples gave to the Spanish portions of whatever it is they produced. And if they didn't produce anything to give, then they gave their labor. How did this work? Well, like I said, all of the land was viewed as the property of the crown. So the crown took all the land on a map and divided it up and would give personal land grants to Spanish nobles. Just like in feudalism, just like what was in Spain. There was no private property. Everything was owned by the crown, and the crown would give you basically a lease where you could occupy the land and make it profitable. And the quid pro quo, you give a portion of that profit to the crown in the form of thanks. Well, the irony is, the king looked at the map, drew little circles on it, gave these grants to the Spanish nobles, who came over and took possession of the land and all of the native people that lived on it. And the native people were expected to work for the Spanish noble. in exchange for the right to stay on their land. So the natives gave tribute to the nobles who gave tribute to the crown and comedia. And what did they give? Literally whatever they produced. So if you were a native and you had been producing coffee beans, gave a portion of your crop. If you were raising alpaca, you gave a portion of the wool. If you were raising bananas, potatoes, tomatoes, or any of the other weird things that were native here, chocolate, tobacco, you continued to produce whatever you had been producing and your family had been producing for hundreds of years. You just gave a cut to the Spanish. Now, the most amazing thing is, for the natives, life did not change. Because guess what they had been doing previous, before the arrival of the Spanish? The exact same thing. Either giving it to the Aztec, who were conquerors and had conquered native tribes, or the Inca, who also were conquerors. Brutal conquerors. So ironically, for the natives, once they converted to Catholicism, once they started speaking Spanish, their lives really did not change. If anything, you could make the argument that it was better. Because what did the Aztec used to do with people? What was this? How? Yeah, human sacrifices. The Aztec had some festivals where they would sacrifice 1,000 people in a day. And you think the Aztec were killing their own people? No, they killed their subjugated people, the people they had conquered. Take them up on top of the temple, spread them out, eagle, usually like an obsidian knife. Cow, open the chest, take out the still beating heart, squeeze the blood out of it. Cut the head off the now dead person, throw the corpse down the stairs, and allow this huge stone pyramid to be coated in blood. Oh, and the Aztecs were cannibals. So they'd carve up the bodies, bring them home for lunch, and the heads, they stacked in mounds. Sometimes they had a couple of games in which they used dead people's heads for like balls. The natives were not hippies by any means. Now, I do want to make one note. The natives that gave tribute to the Spanish nobles, who gave tribute to the crown, they were not treated as slaves. Why? Well, interestingly enough, it goes back to Queen Isabella. When the conquistadors started coming over and the stories of the people that they were coming in contact with were becoming clearer, it was Isabella who basically made the order, which would become law, that any native who works for the Spanish and becomes a Catholic will not be ever owned. They will have rights. They will be treated as subjects of the crown. Questions? No?
Well, you say it's not, it wasn't slavery, but, well, maybe it was before Isabella said that, but they were not treated like they were humans. I mean, they saw them as animals.
Well, yeah, they were running around half naked.
And they were slaughtering them,
too, so... Well, once they took control, they stopped slaughtering them. Okay. They got to get conquered first. Oh, do you want to know a way to get equal rights with the Spanish? The Spanish who came over were all males. and no offense to my lady friends in the room, men have a tendency to want something. Well, under the legal system, if you had a drop of Spanish blood in you, you would be free from the encomienda system. So many natives willingly gave their daughters over to the Spanish nobles, and the moment they did that, the kids that would be produced from that union would be exempt from the encomienda system. They no longer had to give a portion of what they produced to the landlord. They could actually own land. They could go into business for themselves. Which is another reason why the natives converted quickly. Yes.
Is that why people actually do that?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Or the alternative, you can spend the rest of your life working for the man. All right. Now, why was this system in place? There you go. It's all about money. And by the way, don't think the world has changed at all. The government's going to take its cut from you. Except the government's going to take from you more than the Spanish took from the natives. Natives usually had to give about 15% of whatever it was they produced. And if you have jobs, you figure out what percentage of what you actually earn goes to the government. More than 50% when you add it all up. We're not just talking income taxes, Social Security taxes, FICA taxes, all the other things that's on your paycheck, which the government takes before you even get paid. But then gas tax, food tax, meals tax, excise tax, sales tax. You're lucky if you get 50% on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar. All right. So, everybody was working to produce raw goods, something of value that could be put on a boat, those resources, and shipped to the mother country. Now, what if you did not produce anything? Well, you still were able to work. So the encomienda system, in part, is based on what the Aztecs had. But the Inca, oh man, were the Inca brutal. They operated a system which the Spanish described as the mita. This is basically forced labor. In the Aztec Empire, if you were a farmer, you could produce whatever you wanted so long as you gave a cut to the Aztecs. In the Inca Empire, the Inca told you what you had to produce. Oftentimes, the Inca would take an entire village, rip them up, and move them to another part of the empire to put them in a place that had the resources that the Inca wanted. It was called agricultural colonialism. So the crown in the Inca Empire dictated what had to be produced. So, this could involve actually going into the jungle and harvesting something. But this also could involve physical labor. Building roads, building bridges, canals. This also could involve mining. One of the interesting things is the Inca did not view gold and silver and gems as being valuable. But rather, they believed they had mystic properties, which would make it easier for you to commune with the gods. So they already had an organized mining system. They had thousands and thousands of laborers whose only job it was for the state to basically go underground and extract precious metals. Well, when the Spanish came over, you think they stopped it? No, they kept it going. FYI, by 1700, the Spanish managed to extract an estimated 60% of the world's gold that was in circulation in something like 80% of the world's silver supply. All by exploiting the labor in Central and South America, which the previous rulers had done as well. But by the 17th century, the mining operations largely petered out. So that's when the Spanish Empire switched over to producing of commodities, agricultural commodities. Large-scale farms were built that raised livestock. They brought beef cattle over. They brought sheep over. But they also raised some of the local wildlife. In particular, the one beast that's proof that God exists. Llama. Llama are truly divine creatures. They really are. Every time I see a llama, I get down and I bow to them. Llama is God. Alpaca are proof that Satan exists. Because alpaca are evil, cruel beasts. Talk about judgmental. Did you know that if you come in contact with an alpaca, they judge you the first moment they smell you? And that will determine whether or not they like you or not forever. They never forget. And if they don't like you, they will hock a loogie on you of this black, gooey bile that penetrates your cloth on your clothes so much, you better just throw it away because you can't get it out. It's nasty, evil creatures. Llama, divine. Alpaca, antichrist. Now, there were two types of agricultural businesses. There was what we would consider to be like a small farm or a multi-purpose farm. These were known as haciendas. The Spanish noble would basically run a multi-faceted business operation on his land, raising lots of everything. Most of it was for local consumption. So he'd raise chickens, you know, so that way his workers could get eggs, that type of stuff. They harvest lumber, they just produced commodities. Typically, 1/5, about 20% of whatever was produced on the haciendas would make its way onto boats and would come across the Atlantic. If you were a native and you lived on a hacienda, you would get paid. You'd get housing. You'd get a portion of the food. You'd get a portion of whatever clothing was produced. The natives loved working on the haciendas, and many of the haciendas would eventually, over time, become towns and would eventually grow to some of the cities that are in Central and South America. But then you had the large-scale operations that were purely for producing cash crops. Commodities not for consumption in the New World, but rather goods that mostly would be put on boats and shipped across. 80 to 90%. Sugar, tobacco, corn, coffee, bananas, potatoes, tomatoes, etc. The haciendas could find ways of always essentially being profitable because they had the ability, at a snap of a finger, to shift production items to things that had value. Plantations were large-scale agribusinesses dedicated to production of a single crop. Any of you farmers? Know any farmers? Is farming easy?
No.
What's the biggest pain in the ass for farmers that there is?
For us, it's
that's
weather.
Not controllable.
Oh, ours is weather.
Weather. Yeah, 100%. Weather. What happens if your farm gets too much water? or not enough water, or it's too warm, or it's too cold. What happens to whatever it is you produce?
We can't feed our cows, because we're a dairy farm, so we can't feed our cows.
Yeah, your basically production is completely disrupted. Well, the same thing is true on these plantations. The profit margin was small. So the workers that worked on the plantations were not necessarily paid. Who in their right mind would want to work engaged in grueling harvesting of crops year after year after year with little to no pay? Who in their right mind would want to do that? Well, coincidentally, many natives literally bailed on the plantations. They left the farm. They escaped, they went back into the jungles, and disappeared. And the Spanish landlord couldn't find them because all of the natives basically looked the same. So, how are you going to get people to work for you that aren't going to get sick and die or aren't going to run away? We have to get it from somewhere else where labor is cheap. One of the byproducts of the Spanish system would result in the construction of what today we call the transatlantic slave trade, in which the laborers were imported and paid for by a portion of the resources that were exported. All right. I gotta give you my little spiel. A little bit of historical truth. Slavery is one of the oldest institutions in human civilization. Slavery has always existed. Some of the oldest pieces of writing, we're talking those old clay cuneiform tablets, contain records of owners making sure their slaves worked. Slavery comes in different forms. There are some slaves that become slaves as the result of military conquests. There are some slaves that are slaves because they are in debt, debt slavery. There are some slaves who basically willingly sell themselves or sell their children. But the end is always the same. One person owns the right to make another work. Weird, interesting factoid for you. Remember when the Mongolians stopped raiding? Or stopped trying to conquer and started raiding? They were raiding and enslaving the Slavic peoples that lived in the Balkans, in the Ukraine, and into southern Russia. That's where the word slave comes from the Slavs. Because the Mongolians made megabucks selling these people after the bubonic plague to the Europeans. And I think I told you guys, right? There was one point where one of my ancestors, who was an Austrian noble, owned another one of my ancestors, who was basically a Slovak. And I'm sure if you go back in your family lineage, at some point, one of your ancestors either owned somebody or was owned. Chances are you have both. How did it become a business, though? Well, we can thank the Muslims. When Islam spread across North Africa with the coming of the Umayyad Caliphate, as they swept across, the Muslims started coming in contact with powerful African chieftains who wanted the same thing as all rulers of any civilization. They wanted more, more, more. They were more than willing to attack conquer their neighboring tribes and dispose of the surplus population. Originally, this slave practice was known as the Arab slave trade. And literally millions of people were taken from West Africa across the caravan routes of North Africa and basically sold all throughout the Islamic world. Middle East, Arabian Peninsula, into Europe, and as far away as Asia. And it was allowed in Islam. Because according to the Quran, non-Muslims can be enslaved and can be exploited by Muslims. Now, we have no idea how many millions, but it's estimated from the time that the transatlantic slave trade was created up until the Ottoman Empire abolished it in the 1800s, somewhere between 20 to 25 million Africans were marched out of Africa into the Middle East. And by the way, the Muslims were not racists, because the Muslims were also targeting every single inch of the European coastline. During that same time period, they captured about 2 million Europeans and sold them off into slavery. Including some Americans. Any of you ever hear of the Barbary Wars? Thomas Jefferson put an end to that. Now, the key thing that is often ignored was that the Muslims, initially, and then the Europeans later, they didn't go into the jungles and capture the slaves. That's a lie. That's a fabrication that has been embedded into historical books. But it's not based on truth. The truth is, the people who did all the abducting were the Africans themselves. Because the people were divided politically, culturally, ethnically. So they willingly went to war with their neighbors, took them, and made use of them. Coincidentally, side note, that's the reason why Africa was referred all the way up until almost the 20th century as the Dark Continent. And if you look at maps of Africa, they had no idea what was in the interior. They would accurately describe what was along the coasts, because beginning with the Portuguese, they saw that, but they never came into the heartland. Because that was African territory. Now, while somewhere between 20 and 25 million were dispersed into the Middle East, another 10 to 12 million crossed the Atlantic. And what today is referred to as the Middle Passage. Typically, young men, young women. The reason being, life expectancy. Why are you going to bother to go through the expense of shipping someone who's in their 60s across? They might not even survive the trip. And then once they get into the new world, how useful are they going to be? So how were they procured? Business transactions. First the Muslims, and then later the Europeans, they brought with them items of value. Items that they produced in Europe, or resources that were generated in the New World, commodities that the African chieftains wanted. They wanted potatoes and tomatoes and corn and tobacco. Just as much as they wanted guns. They also were willing to take gold and silver. But by the tail end of the transatlantic slave trade in the 19th century, it was mostly done with cash. And also, the slaves didn't just come from one place. Because there wasn't just one African tribe that was a tribe doing slavery. No. Many of the powerful tribes all throughout the continent got into the business. And if you can see by the width of this, most of the slaves would end up coming from West Central Africa. And where they went also varied. Most of the slaves that were procured either went to Brazil, which was a Portuguese colony, or they were brought into the Caribbean. When was the last time you saw someone from the Dominican Republic that looked like a Native American? Or Haiti? Or Jamaica. Those places, the native population was wiped out and the population was replaced. But notice, America gets blamed for everything. But look how small the little line is that goes up to here. Of the 10 to 12 million human beings that were transported across the Middle Passage, only about 400,000 made its way up to what would become America. And by the way, everyone, if you're going to apply blame, everyone's to blame. It wasn't just the Spanish. It wasn't just the Portuguese. Because the Portuguese initially created the transatlantic system, but then the Spanish would take it over, then the Dutch would take it over, and then the English would get involved, and the French, and so forth. And again, it had nothing to do with race. It's all about more. The more laborers you could bring across the ocean to replace the natives that died because of disease, the more goods could be produced and then shipped back to the mother country. This is redundant. I just said it. It was the Portuguese who got there first because we know they hopped along the bottom. But the Portuguese had little use for Africans in Portugal. They didn't have large-scale plantations. But they saw the African chieftains, the slavers, who were willing to basically sell the slaves. They saw the slaves as a commodity. Something if they could get their hands on, they could make money off. Which is weird because the Portuguese were devout Catholics. And where in the Bible does it say that God gives to man the right to own another? It says it in the Quran, but it does not say that in the Bible. So in a weird, interesting twist of fate, in 1452, King Afonso V of Portugal sent a letter to the Pope, Pope Nicholas V, the one who claimed that he ended the conciliarist war. And the king asked the Pope, look, we got these African chieftains, they're willing to basically trade with us and give us human beings for labor. The king in his letter actually said, it feels ungodlike. But the Pope, and of course, we know what the church was like in the 15th century. Looking at it in the sense that if the Portuguese could get more workers and produce more goods, their cut would go up. The Pope actually granted to the king the right to, and I quote, reduce any Saracens, pagans, and any other unbelievers to hereditary slavery. Church law. Of course, that goes all the way back to the Crusades. Non-Christians have no rights. And by the way, over the next 80 years, the fact that the Pope was on board was used to justify the creation of this institution in the New World. But you want to know the funny thing is? Before it all exploded in 1537, Pope Paul III, who we're going to talk about, we'll talk about the Protestant Reformation, he actually changed the position of the church. He declared that all peoples, even those outside the faith, should not be deprived of their liberty. So from 1537 onward, the position of the Catholic Church is no on slavery. But do you think anyone paid attention to what the Pope said in 1537? If someone is coming at you with a big bag of gold coins, or the picture of a poor child abducted from their homes, used to produce that bag of coins, what are you going to say? Be honest. I know what I would say. Oh. One more last little thought. How many of you have one of these? Is there anyone in this room that does not have one of these? Any of you not have laptops at home or with you? Any of you not have a car that has like the digital dashboard display, the little computer processor that's in it, your headphones? Every single modern technological device has in it rare earth minerals that are harvested in Africa today by enslaved children. So don't you dare ever, ever be aghast at what these people did 500 years ago. Because if you have one of these, you are contributing to it. The other thing that we also have to remember is, again, I said it, it's being redundant, but it's on the screen now, I'm just speaking out of order, is that they were not captured, they were bought. So if you purchase something, is that not under the law considered yours? I've already talked about this as well, we've already seen the grid, the breakdown, and I've already covered this as well. It's all about profit. All about profit. But I do got one last little point. One last thing. And suddenly it'll all make sense. The natives were dying from diseases because they never had been exposed to them. Those diseases had been present in Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. So by replacing the natives with Africans, being a labor source, the Africans had resistance to those diseases. So they got sick, but they did not die. So if you're going to make the investment... And by the way, slaves were not cheap. In modern money, typical healthy male set you back about $95,000. If you're going to make that type of investment, are you going to use it and abuse it? No. You want to get money's worth. So if you're going to make that type of investment, you also don't want it to get sick and die on you. Because there was no insurance.
The other thing, if a native didn't want to work on a plantation, they could literally hop the fence and go back into the jungles. What happens if one of these Africans tried doing that?
They can't swim across the Atlantic Ocean, go home. And chances are their homes were already destroyed by the African chieftain that captured them.
So the sad reality is once the system started going, the system sustained itself because of the desire for more. Questions? Yes.
Why weren't Europeans as well?
Because the surplus Europeans were peasants, and they were working on European farms.
But by the way, some would come over.
I was just wondering because you said because of the. I mean, both went through.
Well, we can't say immune. They have resistance.
Resistance.
Yeah. There just was not enough Spanish people in Spain to replace the millions that died off in the New World. Plus, under Spanish law, the vast majority of commoners were considered peasants, and they were owned by the nobles, and the nobles weren't going to let their peasants go across the sea.
I think they had something to do with that. They weren't allowed to buy Christians.
That's part of it as well. Yeah, that's part of it as well. But in the European colonies, a good chunk of the people that came over were indentured servants. So the British would allow a British person to sell themselves in exchange for the passage. And they would come over and they would have to work for upwards of 10 years. But they weren't owned once they did their time, once they generated profit for the owner, then they would be allowed to go free. Other questions?
When did the Irish slave trade come?
Oh, that was awful. It started when the Scots were encouraged to move over. I think that was during the reign of King James I. I think it was the late 1600s, early 1700s. Because that's when the British government basically began emptying all of their prisons. And captains could basically buy the prisoners and then take them over to the New World and they could sell them over here. So yeah, there were tens of thousands of Irish and Scots that were basically treated as slaves. So yes, in North America, they were in fact white slaves. Other questions? All right, what the hell? I know weird things. I actually know who the first slave owner in the British colonies was. His name was Anthony Johnson. Anthony Johnson was one of the 20 Africans that were brought up from the Caribbean in 1620. And when Jamestown was nearly wiped off the face of the earth by the Powhatan Indians, he was one of the people who survived. When the first 20 came over, they were not enslaved. They were treated as indentured servants because England did not have slavery under the law. But Anthony Johnson, when he survived, was given the right to basically own land. And so he bought indentured servants. One of his indentured servants, also an African, attempted to basically breach the terms of the deal, tried leaving early. So Anthony Johnson, an African, went to court and sued for the right to keep the African. Edwards? God, I can't remember what the slave's name was. But the English court basically said, no, under English common law, we don't have slavery. But Anthony Johnson, in his defense, said, yeah, but we have the custom in Africa. And so the court, basically being respective of diverse cultural interests, said, well, okay, well, if you can own them in Africa, well then, I suppose you could own them here. And that's how slavery was brought in the New World. Anthony Johnson. Interesting story. All right, let's wrap this up. Well, Now you suddenly had what in high school you probably learned is the triangle trade being created, where the resources were being produced in the New World and they were being shipped to the mother country, where they would be manufactured into other items or basically determined to be surplus and thus sold for profit. Well, soon ships began leaving Europe and sailing down the African coast and taking those manufactured goods and selling them to the African chieftains, filling up their ships with cargo and then sailing back, exchanging them for resources, bringing them, triangle trade. So let's add to my little middle school grid. 3 points, 3 stops. Colonies still producing resources, sending them to the motherland. Motherland is still manufacturing those into commodities, sending them back to the colonies. Those routes don't stop. But now you have more customers. And by the way, if you have more customers, it puts an increased demand on production. But you have Africa being a source of chattel. Oh, by the way, did I talk chattel? You know what chattel is? It was on the other screen. You know, let's back up again. Chattel. Chattels are your property. They're considered personal items. Because in Old English, property was a phrase used to represent real estate, land. So your property was your land, your chattels were your items. And of course the crown encouraged this because this is wealth generation, this is wealth generation. Everything's getting taxed. And the crown can get more, more, more. Questions. Now, technically I got 8 minutes left, but I don't have enough time to get too far into Portugal. So I think on that note, I'm going to do a mic drop. See y'all on Thursday.